and welcome to another episode of Radio Warner. The date today is March 1st, 2026. First day of spring, according to how a lot of people count spring, at least in Europe, I remember, in Russia. And what a spring it is. We're doing an emergency episode today, of course, because warmongers being what they are, they always want to start these things on late Friday night or early Saturday morning just to mess with our sleep. No, they do it for other reasons that we'll talk about, having to do with the all-important markets. Anyway, I'm the co-host, Mark Ames. I am coming to you from Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe and support the show. Please go to patreon.com/Radio Warner and support the show. And I'm on the line, of course, with John Dolan, the Warner, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in southern Italy. How you doing, John?
I'm a little depressed. I mean, a lot of news doesn't depress me, but this did for a lot of reasons. I mean, just, I don't know. I understand now why people in their old age said, I'm not sorry to be going out.
Yeah. And then there's Trump, who, when he announced his war, which is polling really badly in the U.S., although unsurprisingly, MAGA, you know, the Republicans were also against launching a war before. But as soon as the Dear Leader started the war, the poll numbers from MAGA, at least, went up a lot. It's kind of, and so,
well, now that you've given me a window on Twitter, I've been able to read those today, and that's part of what made me so depressed. Like those, I didn't quite realize before the unbelievable stupidity of most of those people.
Yeah,
I got kind of a distilled version. Their tweets that somehow rose above the norm.
Yeah. It's just 2003-04 again, isn't it? I mean, that to me, it is copy-paste 2003-04.
Yeah. I mean, I think that helps me in a way that I hadn't thought of for a long time. It's like they're not recalibrating. They're not reconsidering. They're nursing an old grudge.
Yes.
That dates way, way back.
Yep. And, you know, I've been arguing, and I think it's true, that much of MAGA's supposed anti-war and anti-neocon, and they have been, you know, rhetorically very anti-neocon and anti-war, that much of it, aside from a few exceptions, is really just anger that Bush humiliated them by losing.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Bush, if that war went well, which, you know, there was almost no way that war under any circumstance, whether he had more troops or less, was going to go well based on, you know, that whole plan. But whatever, if it had gone well, like the people who are MAGA today, what they were in 2002, 2003, 2004, they were gloating over the destruction.
Yeah.
They were stomping on anti-war people and loving it. And then they got humiliated. They got humiliated by how badly the war went and what an absolute incompetent, incompetent fascist Bush turned out to be. So Trump basically says, you know, yeah, that war was bad. Good, we can wash ourselves of that. But my wars are going to be better. We're going to redo it the right way. And everybody's back on board. Well, not everybody. I mean, it's still like 70%, which is less than the usual MAGA support. But it's still 70%, which is insane.
And really, it was useful to me to have a reminder of how stupid a lot of people are.
Yeah.
It's good to think that not everybody, even in their faction, was buying it. But my God, I think even before I had any other pretensions, I had a kind of snottiness about composition and their lack of invention in framing new ways of disguising their real beliefs. It's stunning.
Yeah. I mean, let's first get this out of the way. And this is something I think we've been arguing on Radio Warner from the beginning, 10 years ago, which is there's a class of people, older people with memories, with long memories, who hate the Iranian regime, hate Iranians,
yeah,
and hate the Iranian government, the Iranian state, the IRI, and those people, and have wanted revenge since the humiliations that began in 1979 and went throughout the 1980s. All of Reagan's worst humiliations were dealt to him from Iran and Iran's allies. And that never went away, and it came back again during the Iraq invasion. Like, this is a long revenge. So there are different but overlapping interests between the Israeli state and the American ruling classes, or, you know, imperial class, I guess you'd say. One thing that's different is, as people have said, Trump hasn't even bothered really trying to hard sell, spend a year selling a lie, because initially, Americans were really on the fence about invading Iraq. I remember it wasn't polling so great. And I think it was Powell's speech at the UN that really turned people who were sitting on the fence, because by the time Bush invaded, I think he had 70-some-odd% support for it. Before then, it was a bit more split, like 50s. And so they spent so much time trying to scare the shit out of people. And this time, you know, Trump hasn't bothered really scaring it. He doesn't need to. That's the thing.
Right.
I mean, what we know is the American system is a constitutionally autocratic system of government. All the power for all foreign policy is concentrated in the executive branch. I mean, I don't know if it was always that way. There are precedents going back, as Bill Hoagland, our guest, you know, talked about even in the 1790s. But certainly since the Cold War started, there is no democratic input into imperial policy, none. I think it also relieves some pressure over what happened in Minneapolis. I mean, Trump lost, you know, Minneapolis. Yeah. Like, of course, he killed a couple of protesters, which is horrible, but it didn't turn out well for him. So we had to get rid of that mini Mussolini wannabe guy, and they just kind of did a withdrawal with honor from Minneapolis. I know that there's a part of hard right MAGA, harder right within MAGA, that was really pissed about that. That felt humiliated by that and angry. I don't know how much they're liking this, but it does change the conversation, as they say.
Oh, yeah. And as you say, there are a lot of people who have a much better impulse control and have managed to keep quiet about their real impulses. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them who never recovered or saw any reason to recover from their grudges, mm-hmm, about Iran 1979. I mean, I remember that time. I remember...
No, I do too.
Walking my dog past a backboard, you know, for kickball in what once was my elementary school, now abandoned. And someone had very carefully, these guys were not, nobody in Pleasant Hill was like really hardcore gangster or anything like that. But somebody had taken the trouble to get a knife and scrape "fuck Iran" into that backboard. And somehow that was a big moment for me. Like, you have to care an awful lot about that. Get your knife out and, you know, inscribe it in these stick letters into this kickboard.
The other thing I wanted to say on this is that some Democratic lawmakers are complaining. But here's the thing. So Ro Khanna, he's actually he's kind of a more on the Bernie-crat side of the Democratic Party.
He seems like someone who, if he would consistently show guts, it'd be great. But never quite does.
He was a corporate lawyer, if I remember right. I think it was at Wilson Sonsini, the big Silicon Valley law firm. So it was always kind of strange to see him tacked left. I don't think he was originally. And so I don't know. That might be something that he genuinely believes, and or that's maybe where his constituency is. But his constituency is, I think, in Silicon Valley, and they don't strike me as particularly radical. I mean, they're all about real estate there, real estate and, of course, Silicon Valley. Like their value.
How they can drain the bodies of their little monsters.
I know.
To survive longer.
Right. So he and Tom Massey, who's the anti-war libertarian from Kentucky, who Trump is primarying because he's pushed for the release of the Epstein files and he's anti-war. They had pushed for a resolution to be voted on, basically a war resolution on Iran, because everyone was seeing, including us, and I'll mention this in a minute, that, you know, that Trump was almost for sure going to go to war against Iran. But the so you could, if the Democratic leadership was behind it, you could at least force a vote on a resolution. But the Democratic leadership killed it because they were supposed to vote on it early last week, that is to say several days before the war started, and instead made sure that the vote came a week, is coming next week, that is to say they're going to vote on whether or not Trump can go to war after he's already started to go to war. Classic Democratic move. That's not Ro Khanna and Massey's fault. That is the fault of the Democratic leadership, actually.
Well, and how could they be any worse than they have been? I mean,
they're trying. You know, don't count them out yet. I mean, here's a couple things to think about. One is, so the Democratic opposition to this basically comes down to they're not following the law, which is to say Trump is not following the law, which is to say he didn't come to Congress first for, you know, for consultations and then asking us to, you know, declare war or something like that. Now, number one, I'm really not sure that it's against the law. I mean, how many times going back to the 1790s has a U.S. president launched a war without a congressional declaration of war? And certainly since, I mean, it's been nonstop wars since, you know, since about a century ago.
Against what law? Like,
exactly.
What law is there?
They claim the Constitution, but it's bullshit. It's against procedure. It's against, I think what they're, they want to grandstand in a, you know, maximally hollow way. And they, I guess, are complaining that Trump hasn't gone through the usual kind of theatrics to make it seem like this is a democratic country with a democratic process, going to the people, trying to state his case, going to Congress, having those, you know, New York Times photos taken of black and white photos in the Oval Office of Trump looking out the window with Schumer and, you know, some other senator. Like, he's just doing it because he can. I don't know how else to, he's doing it because he can. But you notice that nobody, including the Democrats, including the EU leaders who've all come out with these insane anti-Iran statements, denouncing Iran for unjustified attacks on bases in the Middle East, that none of them are calling out this, that America has launched in an illegal war. I mean, this is the supreme crime, according to the Nuremberg trials, the crime of an unprovoked war of aggression, or the war crime of assassinating, of murdering a head of state. I mean, there hasn't been a murder of a head of state that we know of anyway, that was certainly done openly and brazenly and bragged about, I think, since 1979, when the Soviets killed the Afghanistan president. I don't think they admitted it for a long time.
What was his name?
Hafizullah Amin, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the last time a head of state's been murdered, but they didn't go around, like, truth-socialing it, you know, and braying about it. I think they hid it for a while.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to mention, that as listeners who follow me on Facebook might recall, I asked yesterday, what was Khamenei doing in his compound? when everyone knew the United States would stage a massive cruise missile and air-launched bomb attack. And some said, oh, he was just eager for martyrdom, but that didn't quite sound satisfactory. Successful politicians don't tend to act that way, no matter what their background mm-hmm. of religion is. They don't want to be martyred as much as the ordinary worker might do. Mm-hmm. So today, it emerged just from another Facebook post, so I can't confirm that the United States, up to the moment that the compound was full of Iranian players, major figures, they were saying, okay, we have to meet about this. You've proposed a compromise. We'll go into it in the coming days. And this apparently was the same ploy they tried with the Hezbollah elite. And it worked then, and it worked now. I mean, do these people not know us? Maybe maybe not. Maybe they're cleaner than we are in some ways. I'm really stunned. But they actually fell for it.
They killed, if they had just killed Khamenei, you might be able to take somewhat seriously the idea that maybe he kind of did a, the Christ scene in Platoon on the poster, that he right. basically willingly martyred himself. But Israel and the U.S., I mean, as one force, they launched, let's remind again, early February 20th, launched hundreds of airstrikes. They killed not only Khamenei, but they also killed Ali Shamkhani, who's the head of the National Defense Council, Iran's defense minister, Aziz Nasserzadeh, the commander of the Revolutionary Guards, the IRGC, Mohammed Pakpour, the chief of staff of the armed forces, possibly the intelligence chief. So they have killed a lot of senior leaders again. And to me, that says, I'm not sure that they were lulled into a sense of complacency, but there's definitely, again, still pretty good penetration of intelligence penetration into
the
Iranian
leadership. Well, yeah, I agree with
leadership.
That. But Khamenei's own compound in downtown
Tehran? Yeah, no. No, that's just bizarre. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's absolutely bizarre. With his son-in-law and daughter or something, and were also killed. Maybe you're right. Maybe they just didn't yet expect it. There kind of is no other real explanation unless they thought, we'll fake him out, put a double in, somewhere deep underground and put myself here. What would be the thinking? They wouldn't dare kill like an old man. It's like the Bugs Bunny. You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses, would you?
I can't see them doing the double thing either. Every aging unemployed actor gets a tryout for Khamenei.
Yeah.
And they say, frown more. And then, you'll do. Stick a beard on
it. You got the scowl down. In the meantime, looking at a map of what the U.S. and Israel, and this is a joint operation, absolutely, that they hit, several cities all around Iran, from Tabriz and Urmia in the north. In fact, there's talk that either the Israelis or the Americans have been hitting Iranian border guards in the north border with Iraq, presumably to help Kurdish, Iranian Kurdish militias to then pour through. Isfahan, Shiraz, Bushehr, this were some of the nuclear work has been done. Naval base in Konarak, Chabahar, Bandar Abbas. So they've hit a lot. Now, what I do think is interesting is how much the Iranians have hit back. And I guess I should introduce this by saying, I just want to say real briefly that we did call pretty much this whole series, at least the first day and a half, pretty well. And I only want to say that because we've acknowledged when we've got things wrong And on top of being completely against this war and absolutely outraged and angry, and I just hate this fucking empire. But I also have a job to do. We have a job to do. And we did get it right. We said that the force that he had, that Trump had gathered, wouldn't make any sense. It was at such, it was so large, unless he actually planned to bomb. And in fact, it looked like at the very end, in the last 2 days, that according to the Omani mediators, that the Iranians were basically giving in on everything. And right. Trump didn't want to hear. Trump had already decided. I mean, there's some reports that say that Trump and Netanyahu already made the decision at the end of December. And it was just a matter of, which probably is true.
Yeah.
So we, you know, we got that right. We said it wasn't enough for a full invasion, but that it would be massive, that the goal would be regime change and state collapse. And Trump made that pretty clear that that's the goal.
Right, yeah. And, I mean, the real thing, if you could sum it up bluntly, more blunt than the news media is willing to be, is assassination on a mass scale.
Yes, yes. Yeah, mass assassination. And they do want to collapse the state. That's the Israeli goal. And I just don't think Trump has thought it through that deeply. I'm not sure that a lot of the people in the Trump apparatus would necessarily want a state collapse. I think they'd rather have an Iranian MAGA guy in power running it, or a Delcy Rodriguez, somebody who's scared and will kind of comply. But I just really doubt that's going to happen. We also said that it would not make sense, and we didn't believe that Iran would respond in a kind of performative, demonstrative way, the way that they have in all the previous engagements with the U.S., because it has not only not deterred, but it has most likely encouraged the U.S., encouraged Trump, of all people, to double down and triple down. And that has
definitely— And they've been using the word existential, which, tedious as it is, means something in elite discourse.
Yep. And so we've seen Iran try to light the Middle East on fire, as well as hitting Israel. And the first day, according, again, a lot of this, you know, you take your information as good as you can get it. There's nothing but flack and lies in war, but you do your best. I saw a pretty good analysis arguing that Iran has fired in the first day over 220 ballistic missiles. Now, think about that. Just in the first under 24 hours, it fired 220 ballistic missiles. In the entire 12-day war, they fired only roughly double that, 550 ballistic missiles. So they've already fired at a far greater scale on the first day. So they fired 220 ballistic missiles, and I saw an interesting report by Ribar, which is like Russian military intelligence-aligned military bloggers who argued that Iran totally changed up their aerial package, I guess you'd call it. But rather than starting off with a whole bunch of drones that all get easily shot down, they started off by firing a whole bunch of dumber ballistic missiles. And remember, since they're going after U.S. bases, I mean, a lot of their shots have been fired at Qatar, especially the UAE and Bahrain. They can use shorter range missiles as well. So they started off firing a whole bunch of shorter range ballistic missiles and just dumb ballistic missiles and at Israel, which overwhelmed a lot of air defense systems and went against what they were expecting. Then they sent in a bunch of drones, and you know, you see, I mean, I gotta say, it's pretty damn surprising to me. And it's still going on. You're seeing these flying lawnmowers, these Shahid 136s. I don't mean to downplay it, but like, I do mean to the extent that it matters, you know, to twist the knife in the U.S. Like, you have a $1 trillion fucking military, and these literal, like, popular mechanics, you know, drones are blowing up, are just zooming happily right past you, la-di-da-di-da, right into, like, radax systems and so on. So, and they're still hitting. In fact, I saw this morning video that some grunt took in a base, a U.S. grunt at a U.S. base in northern Kuwait of a different drone. It wasn't a Shahid. It's thought to have been a loitering munition, but still a slow-moving propeller drone just happily flying over the base while this guy is filming it. And then it's just, it's amazing. And you know, among the things this shows are, number one, taking out the Iranian leadership. And this is another thing we said. This isn't Maduro's regime, whatever. This isn't Saddam Hussein's regime by any stretch. This isn't a one-man regime. It's not even, you know, Khomeini is not even like Nasrallah, which really did more, like in morale terms, really gut Hezbollah. They took the Israelis, or the Israelis and the Americans took out the leader and some serious top level commanders, the defense minister and the head of the, you know, Revolutionary Guards, and everything still went according to plan anyway. In the 12-day war, you remember, it took Iran like 2 days before they really started getting going. They were genuinely, their whole command structure was paralyzed in the 12-day war beginning. And this time, they have not been paralyzed at all. And that's an important thing.
No, I mean,
know.
Well, in Iraq, they basically, most people who were not in love with Saddam, they were relatively pleased, as far as I can tell, that he was out. But then they started to sink back into their regular communities. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out those communities had a lot of anger. Mm-hmm. And they started acting as community warriors. But yeah, I've seen some of these videos too. Like, we know that an oil tanker has been hit in the Straits of Hormuz.
Yeah, two of them, I think, actually.
That, I don't know if you saw this video, Mark, but, and I don't know if it's been verified, but I saw a video of somebody in a high-rise apartment in an authentic American accent, speaking very gloatingly of the rotten air defenses in Qatar, I think, where he was stationed. And that lasts for one strike. And then he instantly, in a different, very different voice, says, "Fuck, I gotta get out of here."
Yes, yes. Yeah, and there have also been a lot of videos where you see Bahrainis, in fact, it's now, they're now rounding up these people, were cheering on the Shaheds and the missiles that were hitting American assets in Bahrain, which is where the, I think it's what, the Fifth Fleet is stationed there, the U.S. Fifth Fleet.
And you know, we've been getting information from a Bahraini source, as you know, that Bahraini are very, very angry about their authoritarian government's refusal to show any sympathy for the Palestinians.
Well, and also that goes back to the fact that in the Arab Spring, and I mean, it's an overwhelmingly majority Shia population ruled by a minority Sunni, you know, royalty that was reinstalled or basically is kept in power by, well, by the Gulf states, by the KSA, by troops from the UAE and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, backed by the Brits and the U.S. I mean, it's, so they're happy to see that. Yeah.
If I could talk to your point about the sequence of the missiles.
Yes.
I've seen an American defense expert argue that Iran is probably going to hold back its best missiles until the third wave. Like an old movie. That the third wave is hypermobile missiles that can dodge, as we saw some of them do in the 12-day war.
Mm-hmm. That's quite possible. We have seen some missiles already that do maneuver towards the end.
And you can tell they're Iranian, as far as I know, because nothing else moves like that.
Yeah. I mean, I was listening to Ted Postol. He's this MIT kind of rocket science expert guy who's not liked by the mainstream. I think he, you know, Elliot Higgins, the Bellingcat guy, used to denounce him as a conspiracy theorist for whatever. But I listened to him talking about some of this about a week ago, and he kind of argued, I mean, he's a physicist, and anyway, he argued a couple of things. One is that the Iranians have a lot of missiles. There are a lot of ways to make a missile upon reentry as it gets closer to the ground to do those kind of maneuvers. You can do something as crude as just bending a fin, you know, and then it's going to be really hard.
Or just have a fin that pops out suddenly because the amount of momentum by that time.
Yeah, because and the, you know, the air defense interceptors, they pretty much have to, in order to destroy it, they pretty much have to hit it head on. And in his view, and I don't know if it's right, and we won't know because this is such, like, the amount of missiles that actually get through is such a closely guarded secret by the Israelis and by the U.S. And the arms makers. But he estimates it's closer to like 5%. And but what I did think was interesting is people seeing all of these Iranian missiles, and not just missiles, but again, drones, getting through to what are supposed to be the best defended bases, certainly should be the best defended in the world right now, which would be U.S. bases that are in target range of Iranian missiles. And all of these slow munitions, dumb munitions, so on, are getting through. And people are acting, I think the BBC even said, you know, do the U.S. anti-defense systems even really work? Is there something we haven't been told? And I can tell you, having followed the Ukraine war for a long time, that there are a lot of, you know, OSINT and experts who have been towing the Ukrainian state line all these years, that they're knocking out, you know, 120% of every, you know, of every Russian drone and missile strike. Like they're completely wasting them. And then others, not just pro-Russian types, although they do it too, but even people who try to be kind of more, they're like real OSINT nerds, have been saying no. They're completely lying, and they maybe knock out, you know, 20, maybe 30% at the best days, maybe half or something. But the actual percentage of that they're knocking out is well below 30% that the Ukrainians are knocking out. Remember, the Ukrainians are using, you know, they don't use our THAAD, but they're using a whole range of Western and American anti-missile systems and air defense systems. And so the Russians have had now 4 years of experience in coming up with different ways, different packages, and different tactics to evade American and Western air defense systems. And I assume, you know, I've always wondered, like, what is the quo pro with the Iran gave Russia the Shahed 136s. The Russians took the blueprint and made their own Gedon, and they've made several generations of Gedons now, including turbojet Gedons. But they've learned about our systems and how they work. And I assume that the Russians have shared this know-how with the Iranians.
Yeah. There's a related problem, which is when your attacks fail and cause massive carnage, what do you then say? And for years, the U.S. and Israeli air forces have been saying, oh, well, first of all, we were aiming for some closely guarded base that was right near the hospital slash school slash, you know, petting zoo, whatever was hit. And we didn't mean to do it. But there's also the fact that you can do the presidential compound pretty well, and this came up because the Israeli Air Force, apparently, in its role as mean little brother, hit a girls' school, and they probably didn't want to because the girls' school was in the south, in one of the regions that they might have hoped to detach from loyalty to Iran, but they killed something like
153 dead. Yeah,
right.
I have seen on Twitter a lot of people trying to argue that actually it wasn't Israel that hit it, but it was wayward Iranian air defenses. And then they do the thing about OSINT is how much you can manipulate it. And I've seen this. I mean, you can go back to the Syrian war, but definitely in the Ukraine war, and then during Israel's Gaza genocide, like when Israel hit the Al-Ali, that hospital early on in its genocide, oh, yeah. right? Remember, and killed dozens or hundreds of people. Very quickly, you had this rush of people, journalists and so on, and including Bellingcat saying, "Oh no, that wasn't Israeli. That was a wayward PIJ missile. It was an accident that they did, but that was not Israeli." And I can do the whole OSINT thing and show you by OSINT, like drawing this, and it's a new form of propaganda, basically, and it has a certain amount of cash. People assume it's more raw and more real and more immune to propaganda because it's citizen journalists. But of course, you never meet who they are. It's probably just some doofus in Haifa or in Langley, you know, just typing away in uniform.
Yeah. I think what we're aiming toward is a lot of this depends on how many missiles does Iran have left? What targets are they going to focus on now? And when are they going to use them?
So there's talk that Iran has just fired one of its more advanced, newer versions of its hypersonic, from its hypersonic missile arsenal. But we don't know how many missiles they have, as you said. We also don't know exactly how many interceptors the U.S. has. And it's a very limited, supply. And Israeli media, Ynet, had an article just today that came out by a commentator who's, I think, pretty close to the Israeli military intelligence and is kind of politically in the center, is considered within Israel, you know, pretty reliable, who said that that already as of late yesterday, the Trump people were already reaching out to the Iranians for a ceasefire, that the U.S. is planned for a 4 to 5 day operation to really weaken the Iranian regime's negotiating position, basically to force them to capitulate, as Witkoff said, to try to get a much better deal that Trump can gloat over, and that he already reached out to Tehran yesterday through Italian mediators, and the Iranians rejected it. And I would imagine that they would continue rejecting it for a while, depending on how many missiles they have. The one thing I'm waiting for, I mean, look, the Strait of Hormuz is closed. And as we've said, this is one of the most, for the global economy, one of the most crucial choke points in the world. 20% of global liquefied natural gas goes through there. Roughly 25% of the world's crude oil goes through that strait. So closing it down will cause an oil shock, an energy shock, and prices to soar. And this will further hurt Trump for the midterms if this happens. And I think the Iranians want this to happen. I mean, this is, again, why Trump launched this thing on Friday, late Friday, in order to not shock the markets and then hopefully have it wrapped up by the beginning of the week. And the question is...
Yeah, I asked you about that. And I remember this was your answer, basically, and that it actually makes a horrible sort of mercenary sense.
Because the shock could actually cause, at least in a day, the first day, a real collapse in markets. They might recover, might not. But if you give people who sort of gamble on the markets, if you give them a few days of getting used to this, by the time markets open, they still might fall, but the shock is going to be less, and maybe you've even by then demonstrated that nothing bad's going to happen, which is why Iran, if they really want to, I mean, Iran has hit, it's pretty surprising how much they've hit. You know, they've really hit Dubai. Yeah. I was surprised how much they went after the UAE. I mean, it makes sense. The U.S. has bases there, and if you want to set the Gulf states, the Middle East on fire, you do go after the UAE. They've gone after even the airport, which is like one of the main aerial hubs in the global system. They went after their main port there. I think it's the largest port in the Middle East. They bombed it. So the Iranians have shut the Strait of Hormuz traffic. And I think the Houthis have now declared that the Red Sea traffic is closed. And that's going to force a lot of shipping to reroute, but a lot of energy won't even go out of the strait.
Well, there's one other possibility that I just want to mention so that we can get it on the record. Everybody is thinking in terms of the new Iranian high-tech armaments. But there was a time, and not so long ago, like I'd say about 10 years ago, when Iran was not even thought to have high-tech missiles in its inventory. What it did have was the Revolutionary Guards, who were seen as something like death commandos, and for good reason. And if you have a sufficient supply of people like that to be activated, and if any of them are not too old, then you give them some Bengay and give them a mission, and they might do rather scary things.
Yeah. I'm looking for a couple of things. One is, will Iran, or is it trying to mine the strait? Because mining is a real escalation, because you don't, it's not like you bomb some sites, some ports, some tankers, but then you stop bombing. So then that ends. When you mine, it's like toxic pollution, right? It doesn't, you don't undo it very easily at all. So that would cause, I think, that would cause a real shock to global energy markets. The other thing is, will the Houthis and even Hezbollah, not to mention maybe some of the Iran-backed militias in Iraq, will they get more directly involved? Because, you know, this is existential for them too. Maybe Hezbollah less so, because they're so deeply embedded in Lebanese society. But if Iran is actually collapsed as a state, or the Shah is, you know, the Shah, the prince, the clown prince is put in power. I mean, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. But let's say Iran does descend into chaos, like that would be pretty dangerous for for all these groups. Maybe not deadly.
So basically, you know, one way or another, Iran A has done pretty well in terms of retaliation, and B seems to have some capacity for further retaliation still left. Mm-hmm. So it will be interesting times.
Iran, one of its missiles, and there are videos of it, did hit Beit Shemesh, which is a bunker, I think, in Beit Shemesh.
Right, nine dead that I saw.
Nine dead. The U.S. just announced shortly before we started recording this that 3 U.S. servicemen have been killed and 5 seriously wounded. They gave no other details about it, where this happened, how this happened, but presumably from one of the ballistic missile strikes or the drone strikes. But yeah, you're right. You know, the Iranians also had the ability to cause havoc and kill Americans in different places around the world, or certainly in the Middle East, through what's called terrorism, you know, car bombs and suicide bombs and stuff.
Yeah. Even in Bangkok, I saw a lot of Israelis, a lot of Europeans. Mm. Like, I don't know if anybody's tried to exploit that yet, but I'd be a nervous tourist.
Yeah. Again, the counterstroke to that is that the Israelis and the U.S. seem to have also penetrated at least parts of the Iranian leadership and military and intelligence, and have had pretty good, they had good enough intel to be able to take out some very important people at the very top.
Yeah.
But they have not been able to stop the mayhem that Iran has been unleashing. So, yeah, I think a lot of it does come down to stocks of precious weapons, missiles versus anti-missile systems. And so all we can do is watch it, because we have no input. This is a fake democracy. Oh. We have no input. And all we can do is watch it and hope for the worst for Donald Trump. Before we go, I just took a quick gander at the New York Times feed. And of course, it talks about this protest, or there have been protests that have broken out in different parts of the world. Massive protest in Karachi against, I think they tried to storm the U.S. consulate in Karachi in Pakistan. And either Marines and or Pakistani police, military fired on the protesters and killed a dozen so far. And then over to Germany, Chancellor Merz, he was asked about international law and if what the U.S. and Israel were doing by waging a Nazi, you know, a war of aggression, which, you know, the Nuremberg trials had deemed already the supreme crime, if he had anything to say about the violations of international law. And he said, quote, "Now is not the moment to lecture our partners and allies. Despite all doubts, we share many of their goals without being able to actually achieve them ourselves." In other words, he doesn't care, and if only we could participate in this, we would.
Yeah. In some way, this era is looking more and more like the Harding era, which reminds mm-hmm. me oddly resonantly of James Wright, the Midwestern poet, who wrote two poems about Harding's tomb, because Harding was a very Midwestern president. And he describes the tomb in really scathing detail, and he says, much like Trump's ballroom, and how over-elaborate it was and how ridiculous for someone who was a mediocre figure in American history. And then he says, if I recall correctly, "But don't look at me. By God, I didn't start this mess. Whatever sun and rain may be, the hearts of men are merciless."
Yeah, I think, speaking of mediocrity and merciless, I do think one thing we need to look out for, at least here in the U.S., is how Trump instrumentalizes this war
yeah.
for domestic purposes, i.e. domestic repression, canceling or fixing elections. I think he sees a lot of domestic angles.
So many of their so-called norms have yeah. been violated, and you think they'll react this time, but no, they don't. I mean, half of his State of the Union speech was raw insults, mm-hmm. and it seemed like that was a violation of the norms I grew up with that were considered presidential. But by this time, it's like the U.S. is an abused family member. Either that or they gloat along happily with the family tyrant, whoever it is.
Well, unfortunately, and I think as even Merz's little quote that I read shows, I think most Democrats support this. They don't want to have done it themselves. They don't want to take the fall for it. But their donors definitely support taking out Iran, and Democrats so badly want to be the party of national defense and the national security state. They really felt that for a few years, and Trump won, and they're losing that status as, you know, who'd have thunk the national security state moves back towards its very right wing, you know, where it's very happy place. But yeah, I think most of the Democrat leadership is on board with the war, and that's why they just want to do a fake sort of protest, because I think the war only has support of something like 5% of Democrats. But that never stopped the Democrats from going against their
party.
No, that
never did. I mean, even Trump's regime itself is not as afraid of defections
yeah.
as you'd think it would be by this time. It's like, I mean, I don't know if he can be elected again. Can he?
No, he can't. No, but he did say, he mentioned, even in the State of the Union, he made a quip about whether he could be run for a third term. And they keep floating that, you know.
But if they can't float it, then this is it for them. So,
I mean, there are ways they could even, look, they can overtly just fix elections or just declare an emergency and suspend the Constitution, which, you know, as bad as the Constitution is, it does make it illegal to run for third term. Or they could do a kind of Putin thing and have Vance or somebody possibly even more pliable than Vance, run as president and Trump as vice president. And then after the win, resign and let Trump be president. Like, there are ways that that they can do it. And I'm sure they talk about it every day to flatter him. But anyways, on that authoritarian note, I think we can wrap up this emergency episode on Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's war on Iran. Yeah, depressing stuff. Anyway, thanks, John. Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.